I'm Brandi Cruz, coming up today on Undivided. It's probably no surprise that Americans have an all-time low level of trust in journalists to do the right thing for the country or to tell the truth. Today, we're going to dive into how local and national media weaponize language to influence how people think about political parties. Plus, Democrats in Washington state moved to make it harder to challenge ballots, while in Congress, Republicans passed the SAVE Act to require voter ID. That and much more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Speaking of low trust in the media, if you have low trust in the mainstream news, consider supporting our show so we can continue to grow and do the work that we're doing. Go to undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com. Click on the banner that says support the show for $5. Hello, hello, friends, and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. Wow, lots to get to, per the usual. Keep trying to convince Nicole, hey, let's do a three-hour show every day. And then she looks at me like she wants to kill me. So for now, we'll keep it at an hour-ish. All right, we've been talking a lot about the media for some self-serving reasons. You know, I'm pretty peeved still that House Democrats won't give me a press pass, and so we had to sue the state of Washington and the Capitol Correspondents Association. But this really is part of this bigger information war that we're in. And, you know, one of the hard truths is that a lot of independent media types are on the right. You know, we don't necessarily have a really robust independent media environment that covers all sides of the political spectrum, and there's a very obvious reason for that. It's the people who didn't really fit in or weren't satisfied with the job that Legacy News was doing happened to be more conservative or more independent-minded. And Legacy News is biased toward the left. I mean, there's been polls out and surveys that show, you know, this most of people who work in Legacy News, and it's not even close, are Democrats or liberals. And so people like me, you know, recognize that, gosh, they're really biased in the way they covered COVID, really biased in the way they cover left-wing extremism, really biased in the way they cover Trump. So we're like, we're out of here. This is a sinking ship, and it's really not doing what the free press is supposed to do. So not a surprise that the numbers are so low when it comes to how many Americans distrust the media. There's this new research from Pew. Majority of Americans express low confidence in journalists to act in the public's best interest. And the kind of quote-unquote approval ratings for the media have been bad for a long time, and they've just been getting worse. Like, they're right down there in the depths with Congress in terms of approval ratings, and oftentimes even worse. But I will say, even these numbers are pretty startling, and it shows a lack of trust on the right and the left. So from Pew, they asked Americans, and this might look familiar to subscribers because I mimicked this question exactly in our daily subscriber show poll, which we'll get to later on, because I wanted to sort of put our audience's thoughts on the media next to this wider national audience that Pew polled. But it asked American adults if they have low confidence in journalists, or what level of confidence, rather, they have in journalists to act in the public's best interests. A great deal of confidence, a fair amount of confidence, not too much confidence, or no confidence at all. Only 6%. 6% said they had a great deal of confidence. I mean, wow, that's pretty staggering. It says on people who lean Republican, that number was even lower. It was like virtually none. And then people who lean Democrat, 9% had a great deal of confidence. So confidence is higher among Democrats, but really not by very much. And Democrats had like 52% said they had a fair amount of confidence, which is higher than Republicans, who say 22% say they have a fair amount of confidence. And if we look now closer at the breakdown between Democrat and Republican, you can see where Democrats line up compared to Republicans, and then the average of all Americans. And kind of this is a perception over time from about 2020 to current. So 43% of Americans have some level of confidence in journalists to act in the best interests of the country. That's low. So obviously it's below 50%. 61% if you're talking about people who are Democrats or lean Democrat, and 25% if you're talking about Republicans or people who lean Republicans. And that tells you really everything you need to know. It's not because like Republicans are conspiracy theorists or they just don't believe what they're told and all these things. No, it's because the viewpoints of Republicans or conservatives are not well represented and not covered fairly by legacy news. That's just the truth. And it cracks me up when people sort of try to deny that, because then you look at statistics and you say, okay, if you're fair to both sides, if you're fair to Republicans and conservatives, then why do they distrust you so much? Now, I believe there's a level and an element of truth that, especially having been on both sides, right? Because I had my TDS, like I voted for Obama, I voted for Clinton, and then I voted for the Libertarian, and then I voted for Donald Trump in 2024. So I've been all over the place, certainly in my 20s, right? Trying to figure out where I belong and what I believe in as I mature and get older and be exposed to these sorts of things. But, you know, it always kind of cracks me up when you have members of the media who, you know, assert that they're fair, and they will continue to say, no, I'm covering this fairly. We're covering both sides. There's really no explanation. I do believe that Republicans, as I was saying, tend to be, having been all over the spectrum, more independent minded. They tend to be better at critical thinking, and they're okay being outside kind of disagreeing with their tribe in a way that I just really don't see on the American left anymore. And that's not to say that there aren't very, very tribal conservatives and Republicans, but they tend to question what they're seeing more often. And I think that's because they've grown deeply, deeply skeptical of the media. I want to give you some national and local examples of things that might seem small, but it's really a weaponization of language. And it's this baked-in bias that has really driven Americans, and in particular Americans right of center, away from legacy news and maybe toward independent media outlets that, yes, have an opinion, but they prefer going to an outlet that's just letting you know, hey, here's my opinion, and not trying to hide it and not trying to couch it as, oh, I'm unbiased, when you're clearly not. It's like, no, I'll just take the person who's biased, admits it, and listen to their information. So, for instance, there was this post by Axios. I actually think they ended up deleting this because they were ratioed so hard. And understandably so. Their post was, crime plunges in major cities despite Trump's crackdown rhetoric. That doesn't even make any sense. But despite Trump, so President Trump, of course, has been talking about, you know, trying to get American cities safer, sending in the National Guard, which he's done in some places like D.C., which resulted almost overnight in a reduction in homicides, for example. And then, of course, ICE is all across the country performing the immigration enforcement that is getting some dangerous criminals off the streets. So really, this should say crime plunges in American cities amid Trump's crackdown. But they want to almost say that it's happening despite what Trump is doing, which makes absolutely no sense, because they cannot give him credit for anything. And not only can they not give him credit for anything, they almost want to act like the improvement in crime and the improvement in public safety, rather, is happening despite what President Trump might be doing. No, you can't bifurcate those two things. He's the president. He's being hard on crime. He secured the southern border. He's out there deporting criminal illegal aliens and sending the National Guard into cities like D.C. And you can't, there's no way you can spin that as not having some sort of positive impact on the crime crisis in America. So that shows you sort of how they think. It's like you can't give President Trump credit for anything. And you have to go above and beyond out of your way to make it seem like when something good does happen, that is happening in spite of President Trump. You know, an example I've thought of lately are the Trump accounts. Daryl, our tech guy, recently had a baby, and I was like, that's so exciting. You know, his baby's going to be in the first generation of Americans to be born with wealth, essentially, because the government's going to put $1,000 in there. You have an opportunity to get it up to like almost $1 million before the age of 30. And this is something that if a Democrat president had thought of it and implemented it, oh my gosh, it would have been the best thing anyone's ever done. Because how much do Democrats complain about, you know, the lack of generational wealth and poverty and income inequality? And now every single American, black, white, Hispanic, rich, poor, they get these Trump accounts and they get the ability to start off on the same footing But no, it's Trump. So, oh my gosh, they get mad because he put his name on it. But I want to give you an example locally of how the media, whether they intend to or not, I like to give them sometimes, on an individual basis, the benefit of the doubt. But then you look at something that's as obvious as what I'm going to show you, and you see how the bias is baked in. And they don't even realize it. And they don't even see the problem with it. So, of course, we're going through this free press fight in Washington State. This is an article from KUOW, which, if you're not familiar, is the NPR station in Seattle. The headline is "Right-Wing Media Allowed in Washington's State House." Now, y'all already know, if you watch this show, that done pissed me off, because I hate being called right-wing, because there's a connotation to it. And I also think it's an opinion, right? I mean, I call people, you know, far left or whatever it is, but I do an opinion show. This isn't supposed to be an opinion outlet. And so when you decide to call people right wing, you're making a decision that they are very, very far to the right. And I just take umbrage with that because I'm a lifelong independent. I'm capable and have on this show of being critical of both political parties. And I hold some views that are actually more left wing. Or at least liberal. I mean, I certainly believe I'm pro-choice, for example. I've always been pro-marriage equality, pro-legalized weed, and even to a certain extent, pro-criminal justice reform, not in the way maybe that traditional liberals see it, but in the way that common sense people see it. So I just take umbrage with the phrase right wing, but it's used so often. So as we dive into this, and I know this author of this story, Scott Greenstone. I actually like Scott. I know Scott. I've spoken to Scott and been on KOW with Scott before. It says, a dispute is escalating in Olympia, pitting right-wing media against the mainstream press and legislative Democrats, and raising questions about who draws the line between journalism and activism as it gets blurrier in the internet age. Three prominent right-wing media figures, podcaster Brandi Cruz, radio host Ari Hoffman, and correspondent Jonathan Cho, were denied press credentials to the floor of the State House in recent weeks. Cruz and Hoffman were denied because of their political advocacy, according to a lawsuit they filed this week, and Cho because he works for a conservative think tank. Now, right wing, again, so I went through the article and I counted all the instances of right wing. So anytime they referenced any of the three of us, it always had that descriptor, right wing. So let's see here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. In a fairly short article, including in the headline, the phrase right wing is used to describe us. Okay. Now you might say, well, you know, they were talking about people on the right. And so if they were talking about people on the left, maybe they would have used the phrase left wing, except they didn't, because they did talk about people on the left in the same article. So they talked about two different media outlets or, you know, think tank sort of things that are on the left. And what phrase did they use? Left-leaning. Left-leaning. Doesn't that sound more pleasant? Left-leaning organizations such as the Northwest Progressive Institute have so far chosen not to apply for credentials, expecting they would be denied because they advocate for legislation. Erica Barnett, who runs left-leaning Seattle news site Publicola, disagreed and called the three activists, pointing to Cruz and Cho's appearance at the White House with President Trump. There's a huge difference between those two things in my mind. And it's also funny because the two examples that they give that they call left-leaning, I would say they're further to the left than I am to the right. I mean, Erica Barnett is a democratic socialist. There's no doubt that she supports socialist-light policies. She has a lot of opinions way further to the left than I do to the right. And the Northwest Progressive Institute is literally an arm of the progressives in the state house that works on their behalf, advocates on their behalf, and for their policies. But they get leaning. Oh, it's fine. It's not scary. It's just left-leaning. These are right-wing. Left-leaning. Right-wing. So it was funny because I reached out to Scott Greenstone last night because he had reached out to me for this story and he included a couple quotes for me in it. But I read the article and I picked up on that right away. And I emailed him back. I said, Scott, do you notice this? Do you notice that you call me right-wing, but you call, you know, the Northwest Progressive Institute and this uber, uber left blogger left-leaning? I said, is that intentional or is that just sort of baked in bias? Because, I mean, you guys must agree with me that it absolutely has a different connotation. Like it makes me sound like an extremist. And it makes the others sound like, oh, just moderate. moderate Democrats, just left-leaning. And he responded and he said, you know, I don't think that there's any difference in the meaning behind it. And he says he sort of talked to his editor about it, and they obviously left it like that. And I didn't ask for a correction or anything. I just wanted to point out to him, you do realize that you use language very differently when it comes to the right and when it comes to the left. And it's like he acknowledges he didn't even notice that. And he said, oh, it makes me kind of think about it, but he didn't change it or anything. But he did that without even noticing. That's how baked in the bias is in the legacy news. Anyone right of center, right wing, they use that phrase all the time. I mean, do a quick Google search. It is very, very hard to find instances in mainstream news reporting where they refer to anything as left wing. They always use a little more specific of a description. But it's right. Everyone's right wing, especially if you support Donald Trump. And I took to social media yesterday and I asked, like, you know, I get called right wing a lot. Like whenever the Seattle Times or anybody does an article on me, a news article, I'm always called right wing. And it just fascinates me because I'm thinking, what position do I hold that would be perceived as extremist? Like what, genuinely, Nicole, what's the most extreme position I hold?
I actually don't know. Think it's only the support of Trump. I think that's the that only thing that makes because people call anybody that.
Are they really going to say I'm right wing because I don't believe boys are girls? Am I right wing because I don't believe we should butcher children and cut their healthy genitals off?
I mean, I like, think
they can't argue that. They might think it, but well, they never say that.
I think some would, but that's the thing is if you hold an opinion that anyone on the left has, which some on the left think boys are not girls. And so I wouldn't call that so extreme because it's there's not people extreme. On the other side that believe yet.
Like I genuinely cannot think, you know, I'm pro legal immigration. So it's not like they could call me like a white Christian nationalist. Mm-hmm. I'm not even religious. You know, usually those phrases for the extremists, they tie to some sort of extremist, like religious, whatever it is. And so it's just that they just think, let's say it. Anyone right of center is an extremist to them. And that's why like 2% of Americans on the right told Pew that they have a very high confidence that journalists are acting in the best interests of the public. 2% of Americans on the right. And then they have these meltdowns because, oh my gosh, you know, independent news and stuff, they want access to what we're doing. We can't allow them to have it. They're just activists. No, we're filling a void. We're filling a void that you are leaving intentionally open by just disregarding and vilifying and painting as extremists a huge swath of the American population. If you don't want shows like this one to succeed, if you don't want people like me to leave legacy news and go try to do things independent, then maybe you should just do a better job of actually being fair and really trying to confront your biases. And I mean, and when I emailed Scott, even though he said what I said made him think, I think if he was really thinking, he would change it. And he would use more descriptive language. You know, I'm an independent. But they'll say, oh, no, just because you call yourself an independent, no, that's not true. You're right wing. And that's an opinion that they're putting about me in a news article. And they're doing it, whether they know it or not, to influence people's perceptions of me in a way that I think is frankly inaccurate. All right, we'll get to Unbelievable coming up next. So as you guys know, in Congress, the House just passed the SAVE Act to require voter ID. Well, in Washington State, we're just doing the opposite. Whatever the Republicans do in Congress, we're doing the opposite. And in Washington State, they're pushing through a bill that would make it more difficult to challenge shady ballots and shady registered voters. We'll discuss first. There is a lot going on in the economy right now. And you see like the markets take off, but then there's all these other indicators, like what's happening with AI and concerns over jobs. And I don't know about you, but it has me definitely worried about, do we have this economy that's just built on a house of cards around AI? So if you're concerned about AI, if you're concerned about a tech bubble, you know, we've got all these layoffs happening in the tech industry in Washington State and elsewhere, it's probably a good time to get a second opinion on your retirement portfolio. Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwark Capital can do that for you for free. Just say, hey, Zach, Brandy said you take a second look at my retirement portfolio, and he'd be happy to do that, him or a member of his team. And he'll go over how Bulwark is focused on risk management, how they incorporate value-based principles in managing retirement portfolios. So they're always looking for opportunities to lower your risk, lower your cost, give your retirement as much upside as possible, which is what all of us want. So it's important to have someone who's looking at that proactively constantly to make sure we've got to mitigate risk where we can. So schedule your free Know Your Risk portfolio review and subscribe to Zach's daily market recap at knowyourriskpodcast.com. That's knowyourriskpodcast.com. All right. While Republicans nationally are trying to make our elections more secure, Democrats in Washington state are working to make our elections less secure. That's not hyperbole, but I'll present both sides and let you decide in our segment, Unbelievable. All right, you guys already know how I feel about vote by mail, although maybe day by day you're chipping away at my laziness for just wanting to put my ballot in the mail, and maybe one day I might come around to the idea that mail-in voting isn't a good idea, especially if Democrats continue to deny the reality that there are some clear, unique challenges that vote by mail present. One of them is very obviously the chain of custody issue, which no one can deny. It's like you put that thing in the USPS mailbox and it's sort of like up to some postal employee to make sure it gets to where it's going in the form that you sent it. I understand some chain of custody issues. We had an actual case where I think it was 17 felony charges against an individual. Maybe it was a little less than that. I might be conflating two cases, but an apartment manager who people had moved out, there's a stack of ballots in the mailroom and she decides just to fill them out and forge signatures and send them in. So your vote, which is your ballot, right? It's open to a lot of different people throughout the whole process of it getting to you and then it getting back in. And there are some challenges. Whenever you have Democrats just deny that outright or not look at ways that they can fix it and tighten up the system, it is bothersome to me. And it makes me think, well, gosh, maybe you guys are onto something when you say that vote by mail is just not trustworthy. And then Democrats do stuff like this. So on the floor of the House in Washington state, the Democrats, total party line vote, Republicans no, Democrats yes, passed House Bill 1916. It's the first time we've talked about this on the show. It has to do with election integrity, at least in their mind, I guess. But there's a process in Washington state where anyone can challenge the validity of a vote or a ballot. And then basically the county auditor goes about trying to confirm that this person is like alive. Like, let's say you think a dead person cast a ballot and there's an issue. Okay, you can challenge it. And then they could hopefully figure out, is this person dead or alive? Or if you have some sort of issue, you know, we're a motor voter state. And in our state, you just have to attest Scout's honor that you're able to vote, that you're not disqualified from voting, that you're a legal citizen, and you just, when you get your driver's license, you might not even understand what you're signing. You get a ballot in the mail, you might turn it in. So we have a process to be able to challenge ballots on an individual basis. Well, Democrats claiming that this is about protecting democracy want to make that process more difficult, and they want to expose people who, in good faith, challenge a ballot to criminal prosecution. Because, of course, that would dissuade people from doing it. So I want to read some of the changes that this bill makes. So it says the challenger must file a separate voter registration challenge form or official electronic voter challenge form as provided under state law for each voter whose registration is challenged. So you can't just challenge a batch of them, for instance. You'd have to do a separate individual form signed with ink. Not digitally, not electronically, signed with ink for every single individual ballot that you want to challenge, even if there's something where they're all related. You know, you had a batch where there was some sort of issue with it and you were going to challenge all of them. Nope. You got to sit there, individual form, sign it with pen, and then get it mailed in. So they're trying to make it more cumbersome. And then it says each form must include the challenger's name, address, and contact information, the challenger's challenged voter's name and address, a statement of the factual basis for the challenge, including any information required by this section. Challenges must be based, this is a key, on personal knowledge, which for these purposes is defined as firsthand knowledge through experience or observation of the facts upon each ground that the challenge is based, and contain any documentation or evidence supporting the facts upon which each ground for the challenge is based. The challenger's signature certifying that all information provided in the form is true and correct, and a clear statement providing that such certification is subject to penalty of perjury. So you have to have firsthand information, which is crazy because let's say that, you know, you've got someone on an anonymous Reddit forum who's saying, hey, you know, I cheated on this or whatever, or I saw this happening at my apartment complex like that. Our apartment manager is just taking ballots and she's got a stack of ballots in her office. Well, that's not firsthand information. And you've got to attest to this under penalty of perjury. And you have to lay out specific firsthand personal knowledge of the potential that a ballot was cast fraudulently. And if you do so without adequate proof and you challenge a ballot, you could be subject to criminal prosecution. It adds this. Any challenger, so there's two different standards here. This first one, I might agree with. Any challenger who knowingly provides false information as part of a voter registration challenge under this chapter, either before or during an election, is guilty of false swearing, with a fine in the amount fixed by the court, not more than $10,000. Now, I don't necessarily have a huge issue with that. You know, our elections offices are busy. And if you're just going to have some troll out there, like challenging every single person's ballot and knowingly providing false information and signing a document, that's kind of a different situation. But get this. Any challenger that knowingly challenges a person's voter registration without reasonable cause, either before or during an election, is guilty of a misdemeanor. Each instance where a challenger knowingly makes a challenge without reasonable cause constitutes a separate offense. What the hell is reasonable cause? And who gets to decide what reasonable cause is? I'm guessing that the Democrats' definition of reasonable cause as a much higher burden than what other people's definition of a reasonable cause might be. So now, as someone who might think that there's a suspicion that someone cast a ballot who's not supposed to, or cast a ballot for another individual in their household who maybe died or moved out of state, and you're still getting it. I mean, I told you guys, I got a ballot for my brother years after he moved out of state. And I kept calling the Secretary of State, like, why am I getting this ballot? And they kept coming and they kept coming. And I'm an honest person. So, of course, I tore it apart and I recycled it. But there's a lot of instances where people might have an opportunity to commit fraud. And so if you suspect, well, is it reasonable? If Democrats don't think it's reasonable, you could be guilty of a misdemeanor crime. To me, it's clear. They want to chill people's right to be able to challenge a ballot. So there was debate on this on the floor. State Representative Beth Dolio, a Democrat who is sponsoring this particular bill, made her case.
Across this country and across this state, we've seen a surge in mass voter registration challenges, often based on flawed data, conspiracy theories,
unreliable
technology. The vast majority of these challenges are rejected, but not before they overwhelm election administrators, intimidate voters, and discourage lawful participation in our elections. These laws have historically been used to target newly naturalized citizens, voters of color, students, people voting overseas, people with disabilities. Even a baseless challenge can make an eligible voter think twice before going to the polls. House Bill 1916 brings clarity, fairness, and uniformity to this process. It empowers election officials to dismiss meritless challenges. It requires individualized affidavits, and it raises the standard of proof and imposes accountability for frivolous or false claims. Washington has long been a leader in protecting voter rights. This bill ensures that we continue that legacy by safeguarding voters and strengthening trust in our elections.
So I love how they always paint voter suppression efforts and efforts to suppress democracy. And that's what this is trying to ensure election integrity, the integrity of our elections. It's like, no, we can't do that because that would hurt voters. That's not fair to voters. It's like, you know what's not fair to voters? When their vote gets canceled out by someone who legally isn't able to vote. That's not fair. I think that that's something that you should care about. Here's State Representative Jim Walsh's response.
Mr. Speaker, it is important that we restore trust in our elections. On that much, I'm sure we agree. But, Mr. Speaker, the method, the means, the process by which we go about restoring and assuring trust in our elections, Mr. Speaker, that's where opinions differ. And, Mr. Speaker, we are at a point in time, as you've heard, where trust in our election processes is not high. And it's resulted in low voter turnout in this state. Mr. Speaker, what this bill does is it raises the barriers to citizens, rightfully registered voters, and for that matter, non-voters of concern in this state to exercise their lawful duty to act as a check on a system of registering voters that does not have enough checks and balances in it. Mr. Speaker, as you well know, in this state, we have automatic voter registration. And while this is a well-intended system to try to encourage voter participation, in the time that automatic voter registration has been our policy, voter participation has actually declined. Now, how can we correct this? Well, Mr. Speaker, we have a process of correcting it. And it's not involving conspiracy theories, and it's not involving illegal discrimination. It's a good system in our current law by which the people can act as the check.
And remember, I've said for any sort of legislation or effort introduced by either side that has to do with voting, it's always, always going to be driven by the outcome. You're never going to have a political party that pushes for any sort of change to the voting process that does not benefit them. Of course, that's common sense. Republicans aren't going to do it. Democrats aren't going to do it. So when you see them pushing for something, it's because they believe that it benefits them. So think about that and apply it to this situation. Democrats want to make it harder to challenge ballots. Why do they believe that that would benefit them? Well, probably because they know that if some of these ballots are challenged, that it might take votes away from Democrats. Because there's no other reason, right? There's nothing else they're trying to protect for here. If they didn't think it would be an issue and all these challenges are going to fall flat, then I don't believe that they would be spending any time on this. Similar situation right now with what's happening nationally, except a little bit different. So the Democrats are trying to reduce protections for election integrity, and Republicans are trying to increase protections for election integrity. But the motive is going to be the same. Republicans believe that if they make the elections more secure, they require voter ID, that will actually help them. And they're probably right. They might think if fewer, illegal aliens are able to vote, they're probably more of them are voting for Democrats. So if we can take that off the table, regardless of how many ballots it might be. So as you know, as this is happening in Washington State, in Congress, Republicans, with the help of one Democrat, just one, passed the SAVE Act.
On this vote, the yeas are 218 and the nays are 213. The bill is passed without objection. A motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
Some cheers, a little bitter cheers. And just one Democrat. So this would do a couple things. It would create a new federal proof of citizenship mandate. So if your state wants to participate in federal elections, which every state does, of course, then you would have to mandate voter ID, which we do not in the state of Washington. So that would have to change here. It would impose requirements for states to keep their voter rolls clean to make sure it's only eligible voters. Require information sharing between state election officials to make sure that somebody's not registered in two places. And also, if an illegal alien is found to be registered to vote, it would enable a faster reaction from DHS. Basically, states would have to know, and then DHS could say, okay, that illegal alien is going to be removed from the country because they illegally tried to vote or did vote in our elections. Let's see some reactions from both sides. Here's Congressman Mike Baumgartner of our state, a Republican.
Hey, everybody. Congressman Michael Baumgartner here. Just voted yes on the House floor on the Save America Act. We need to restore trust in our elections, and that starts with making sure that the only people that vote in our elections have proof of U.S. citizenship and have voter ID. If we can have ID for things like buying alcohol, cigarettes, and so on, we certainly can have ID to make sure that only Americans are voting in our elections. So proud to make this vote. We all need to work on that.
And then as far as Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal of our state, who represents the Seattle area, a Democrat, she says this is nothing short of voter intimidation.
We're filing cases in court around states that are trying to suppress voters, you know, refuse to provide water to people at the polls, all the ways in which voters are intimidated, including, as you mentioned, new ID requirements that Republicans are trying to get into many places.
Yeah, so apparently that's all about intimidating voters. And I've spoken out before about long poll lines. I'm like, and some of that happens in blue states. Like, you're saying that voter ID makes it so difficult to vote. You know what makes it difficult to vote? Having to take work off and stand in line for 7 hours. That's absolutely absurd. There was this really interesting exchange that I think is really telling in all of this. So CNN, they have that panel show with Abby Phillips or whatever, and Scott Jennings is like the star of it, and I think that's the only reason that show stays on the air. And he's, you know, Republican, and he's always debating. It's funny, it always ends up being like 4-on-1, like the host Abby Phillips and the Democrats, they all gang up on Scott Jennings. But he was listening to some of the accusations from a Black Democrat on the panel about how this was racist and it was designed, voter ID and the SAFE Act is designed to suppress the votes of like poor people and women and people of color. And he kept pointing out that she wasn't actually explaining why. And I think it just absolutely exposes the fraud of that argument.
What voting rights is he taking away from Black voters?
Oh, if we look at
the SAVE Act,
that's exactly what we're talking about. That is actually going to continue to disenfranchise overwhelmingly a lot of people of color. There are so many civil rights organizations that have run the data. If we look at the way that it is going to disenfranchise Black voters, it's the same reason why Chuck Schumer called it Jim Crow 2.0. So this is the same president. If we want to continue.
You haven't said how yet.
I am talking about it. It's the way that you're putting new poll taxes on this when you're making people have. That's what we can call them now. It's kind of an idiom, right? If you want to say that people have to prove that they are citizens, that they have to prove with a voter ID, the reality is you're layering what is a constitutional right for the American people and making it harder for people to vote in this country. And it's going to disenfranchise Black voters.
Does it concern you that you're making all these claims? You've yet to lay out how it's hurting anyone, but 76% of Black voters think we should show an ID to vote, 80% of Hispanic voters, 83% of the American people. Are you saying that Black voters
the
are
SAVE
too
Act
dumb to know
just,
what's good for them?
I mean,
it sounds
isn't
pretty,
just about,
it sounds pretty
that's
condescending
that's
to what I mean.
Clear, that's not
you get three-quarters of Black voters
that's not,
who want
right.
voter ID.
But to be
not,
clear, the SAVE Act is not just about ideas. The SAVE Act is about proof of citizenship.
So what?
So you should be thinking about your constituents or your
yeah, I think they're smart enough to figure out how to register to vote, Abby.
Hold on. Most Americans don't have a passport. Many Americans don't have access to their birth certificate. Many women, a majority of women who change their names for marriage have to provide additional proof that they've changed their legal names in order to register to vote.
I have heard Democrats make these same arguments.
So Scott, why don't you actually respond to the substance of what I'm saying?
I am. And
as opposed to making this about something that it's not.
You're saying,
it's not just about voter ID.
It's
also about who has access
and rural people are too stupid to figure out how to register to vote.
No, that's not
what
Democrats
are
making this argument all the time.
Hang up on Scott.
It doesn't matter to me where people live.
I guess I have a little more faith in rural America and
I don't know why you think you're making this about whether you're smart or not.
You're saying that they can't vote.
All right, Nicole, you can take this down. I don't need to listen to them gang up on Scott Jennings
anymore.
Because they can't answer the question. He kept saying, well, how? How does it do that? And she couldn't say because she's just spitting out the lines that this is racist, this is voter suppression, this is whatever it is. And he's just answering simple questions, specifically how. And then, of course, Abby Phillips comes in to try to save her friend on the left and makes it about, again, rural voters. And I'm not, let's not be stupid about it, right? Of course, there are some people who might have to take a couple extra steps to prove that they're able to vote. And I think most people would be able to do that. And to Scott's point, well, they're not stupid. They'll figure it out. Any new law like this, there'll be enough notice to be able to do what you need to do. But the other thing is, this should have been the law all along. So yeah, might it be a pain for people who are already registered to vote or whatever it is, sure, but they should have had to do this all along. We're just going back and fixing a common sense, and I have to pull this up really quick on the voter ID. Congressman Michael Cloud, and I never knew this. I didn't know this how they vote. He was pointing out that he said, notable that 213 Democrats just used their congressional photo ID to vote no on a voter ID bill. And he said, for reference, this is how we vote in the U.S. House. You have to insert your congressional photo ID and then you have to press the button. So they even have to do it there in order to vote this down. The idea of voter ID. Look, sometimes important things can be difficult. Sometimes, I mean, if you want to fly to see someone, you've got to figure out your ID. If you want to go buy booze at the store, you gotta bring your ID. So yes, if you want to help choose the president of the free world, you have to have your ID. And this is non-controversial. As Scott was referring to there, Americans across different races, different ideological lines, different socioeconomic lines, they overwhelmingly support the idea of voter ID. Pew Research, 83% of Americans support requiring all voters to show government-issued photo ID in order to vote. 83%. You know how few issues there are in America that have 83% support, especially ones that have been politicized in the way that this issue has? Yet you've got people like Democratic Congresswoman Delia Ramirez, who believes that if you support voter ID, you're a racist white supremacist.
Look, as I hear my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, what I hear is the same racist, misogynistic trash, different decade. The Save America Act is yet another Republican attempt to intimidate and suppress the votes of anyone who threatens their extremist white supremacist agenda.
And so, okay, so black people are white supremacists? 83% of Americans are white supremacists? Hispanic people are white supremacists? It is the laziest talking point. It is one of the biggest turnoffs for me to Democrats and the left is everything is racist. And they think you're so stupid that if they call something racist, you'll be like, yeah, oh, I don't like racism. Racism is bad. And you won't question it any further. There's actually this comment that came in on the live stream that I thought was very it's disappearing on me, but I want to read it. Hold on. Oh, yeah. Country guy. This is such a good point. Can we make voting as easy as it is to practice your Second Amendment rights? And the truth is, it's very hard in this country and in a state like ours to practice your constitutionally protected right to bear arms. I talked about my personal experience. It took me a full month to go through the process of buying a gun. There's a 10-day period. You go in, you register for it, you got to come back, drive all the way back twice. I had to go to a place in Tacoma, pick up my firearm. And they're making it even more difficult starting in 2027. You have to take live fire training. And that's a constitutionally protected right. So let's make a deal. Let's make it just as hard to vote as it is to get a gun. Because you're talking about that's a right. We can't make it too difficult to exercise a right. Well, look what you did to Second Amendment rights. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. There is no legitimate argument against voter ID. There is no legitimate argument against voter ID. Now, this SAVE Act is going to have more of an uphill battle because it has to reach that 60-vote threshold in the United States Senate in order to deal with a filibuster issue. So this is going to be a much taller task in the Senate, but it shouldn't be. Think about that. All members, how many did he say it was? 213? 213 Democrats voted against it. One voted for it. Yet 83% of Americans support the idea. So technically, like a large percentage of Democrats, a little lower than 83%, about 70%, should have voted for it, but they didn't, because it's all about what their party wants to do, what their party leadership wants to do. All right. Let's see here. Coming up next, State Representative Travis Couture is going to join us to talk about these really difficult efforts to try to protect children in the state of Washington from overdosing on fentanyl being used by their parents. It is shocking how hard it is to get common sense legislation just to say, hey, kids shouldn't have to be in a house with a deadly drug. They shouldn't have to be exposed to fentanyl that can kill them in an instant. We'll discuss that coming up next. First, February is Valentine Roofing Month. Because why? You can spread the love of Valentine with your friends and family. If you got a new roof or new siding from Valentine, they are extending through the month of February their customer referral program and expanding it. So if you refer friends or family for a new roof or siding, you'll earn your choice of a free maintenance service or a $250 gift card. And as you know, you can be confident when referring your loved ones because every Valentine Roofing customer receives the Valentine experience. Seamless communication, meticulous cleanup, and extra mile service. Even in winter weather, there's a reason Valentine has been named the best roofing company in the Pacific Northwest for 3 years in a row. And they also have flexible financing options with payments as low as $159 a month. So a Valentine roofing, a roof is a roof that's built around your budget. So reach out to your free estimate, 206 Roofing. And again, if you get a new roof or new siding, make sure you take advantage before the end of February in that referral program. All right. First, a follow-up to a story that got a lot of attention. So last week, we had a couple parents on the show who yanked their kids out of public school over these ICE protests. One of them was this dad named Vance, whose son was at Cascade Middle School in the Highline School District, which is in White Center, like south of Seattle, pretty high crime area. And the dad was freaked out because he gets a call from his kid saying, pick me up. I feel like I'm being forced to go to this ICE protest. Here's a video the dad posted at the time.
So my son just called and said that his school just brought him to a protest. So he's currently at a protest. I'm fitting to go rage.
I'm fitting to go rage.
Yellow hair? Oh my God, my kid is at a woke school. What is going on? This is Cascade Middle School, everybody. Cascade Middle School. Did you consent to that?
I didn't want to.
You didn't want to do that?
No.
I'm finna go rage. Then that realization, oh my God, my son's at a woke school. But he had every reason in the world to be concerned about it. His son, it was like either stay alone in this classroom or he felt kind of pressured, he says, by students and staff to go out and be part of the protest in one of the most dangerous areas of the state. Like with gang violence, and they're out on the street. And this is just days after two Seattle public school students were shot and killed by a bus stop by a school. So it's just insane. And Vance, of course, came on the show with us to talk about the ordeal.
My son actually showed me the video of them actually walking through the street, in the middle of the street, down. They must have went 10 blocks up and back and forth through White Center, Washington. And mind you, I have to keep this very point and blank that is a very dangerous area.
Yes, it is.
You know this.
Yes, White Center is like gang violence central.
Yes. Oh, that was my biggest concern. And the teachers can say that they give them an option. There's no option for a child. It's up to the parents' consent. Children cannot consent.
Yeah, and he said after he came forward with his story, he says his son was getting threatened by other students and all this crazy stuff. So that dad who was finna in a rage, what is that? Went and finna in a rage at the school board meeting. Here's a video.
It used to be political, now it's personal. Our children are involved. I am sick and tired of watching politicians and school boards, people from the city, telling children they can go out and get in the face of law enforcement. Good evening, my name is Vance Kalabi, and on the afternoon of February 2nd, 2026, my 14-year-old child called me. He was not at school, he was not sick, he was in the middle of White Center, Washington, in the middle of a protest that was organized for his middle school. Okay, my stomach dropped when he called me. You guys have noticed that on January 30th, 2026, two children were killed just blocks from a school on Rainier that was having a very walkout that day. RCW 28A600035, by allowing them to leave and under Initiative 2081, the Parental Bill of Rights, I have the right to know where my child goes. That was taken from me. I was not given notice. I was not given an email. I was not given a call. You exposed him to real danger. That's neglect and that's endangerment. RCW 9842035, criminal negligence by not being aware of the substantial risk. You call it policy? I call it abandonment. I am filing a lawsuit before the Paul Johnson. I want to make something perfectly clear. Someone's going to be held accountable, but all of you will remember it. Because for some reason we lose our case, we'll make a case law out of this to protect parents' rights to know where our kids are at all times. It's ridiculous. It's criminal negligence. And yes, a principal was fired for coercing students participate in protesting. Just so you know. I had an hour worth of yelling to do, but today I'm going to narrow it down to 2 minutes because you didn't give me enough time. But I will be here at every school board meeting to continue what I had to say today. I am not finished. I yield my time.
Who's like disrupting in the background? Is that somebody just, I don't know. But yeah, I love that he dropped an F-bomb before he even started his official testimony. He's like, F, whatever. And then he's like, my name is Francis. I was like, oh, there was a preamble to the speech. And I actually think that he's incorrect. And there was this misinformation going around about a principal being fired locally.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's actually true. And I think that was somebody trying to correct him on it. But I'm glad that there was follow through there. And I'm waiting to see that in Puyallup with all the stories we've done in the Puyallup school district on the female wrestler who says she was sexually assaulted by a trans male opponent and all the stories on what they've done to girls there and just shutting them out and not taking their concerns seriously. There's a Puyallup school board meeting, I believe, on the 17th of February. And I mean, that's how there has to be follow through. It's not enough, as you know, Vance did initially, to just get on the internet and explain what's happening. I think that's helpful to show other parents you're not alone in this. But then where's the follow up? His follow up is like, I'm going to the school board meeting to rage in 2 minutes, fit all my rage into 2 minutes. And then I'm going to file a lawsuit against your school district for basically child abandonment. So I wanted to play that follow up for you.
There was some like, oh, like when he swore, they were all surprised. Oh. I'm like, literally those kids that walked out were yelling F ice.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
With the word.
So if you're so clutching your so pearls offended over that, you might want to talk to your kids who were out there yelling about ice. Yeah, I don't suggest dropping F-bombs at school board meetings, but it's okay to be mad because they are your kids and it is personal. All right, there has been a years-long battle in the state of Washington over something as common sense as just protecting kids from homes where there's active substance abuse. So as you know, in 2021, the Washington State Legislature passed something called the Keeping Families Together Act. And frankly, Republicans were duped into voting for it too. And the idea was, hey, we want to keep families together to the extent possible. But what it really did is lower the threshold to be able to remove a child from a home where there's drug addicted parents. And when fentanyl came on the scene, I mean, everything changed. Not to say, I mean, using any drug around your child is bad, but there really hadn't been a drug that in such small contact could kill a child in the way that fentanyl could. And what we saw after the Keeping Families Together Act was passed is a rapid increase in the number of children who were killed or who were almost killed by being exposed to fentanyl in the home. And that's not according to me, that's according to the state's own data. So there are a couple bills. Now there are finally some Democrats who are coming around to the idea of trying to fix the Keeping Families Together Act. For instance, there's a bipartisan bill that I think will pass this year that finally has to do with child endangerment, basically, where fentanyl wasn't even in the child endangerment law. So there were different rules if you exposed your child to meth versus if you exposed them to fentanyl. And all Republicans had been trying to do last session is say, hey, we should probably add fentanyl to the list. And Democrats were like, no, we can't do that. That would be vilifying parents who have a substance abuse disorder. And whatever happened over the summer, now Democrats are finally on board with saying, yeah, let's add fentanyl to the list. But there's this other effort of like, because that bill is really helping kids, like, sometimes when it's too late, like when they've already been exposed and died or nearly died. And so there's also this effort to try to right the ship on the Keeping Families Together Act to make it easier to take a kid out of an environment like this. So Representative Travis Couture has been trying to fight the good fight and make sure there's teeth in whatever effort they put forth. So there's something right now going through that has a Republican or a Democrat sponsoring it. It's House Bill 2660. And, you know, this is tough because they're putting this bill forth, and the idea is to protect babies and toddlers from these situations. But the fact that there's no Republican co-sponsors on it, automatically, I'm just going to say it, is a red flag to me that it doesn't do very much. Because they've been so hesitant to take kids out of drug addicted homes. And so the fact that there's not one Republican co-sponsor on it, I'm like, I guarantee this is, doesn't do enough. And State Rep Travis Couture went on a total rant during a committee hearing about just that, saying this is lipstick on a pig. This is so you guys can act like you're doing something, but it doesn't actually make it easier to take a kid out of the home where there's substance abuse. And so I saw that rant in a committee hearing, and I wanted to have Representative Couture on the show today to explain what he means by that. Representative Couture, welcome back to Undivided.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, I know we've talked to you a lot about sort of the fallout from the Keeping Families Together Act and what are we going to do to fix it. I will say off the bat, it seems like there's more bipartisan support for changing some things than there was last session. Is that fair?
Yeah, there's a growing amount of obviously all Republicans want it changed, but there's a growing amount of like moderate Democrats and some who are not moderate who want to change it. But there's still this subset of Democrats who want status quo and don't want to change it at all.
Yeah, even so, I mean, there's some Democrats who refuse to acknowledge that the Keeping Families Together Act is even a problem that contributed to the rise in kids dying.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the numbers just are undeniable anymore. So anyone who doesn't think that there's a problem is just living in a fantasy. We have a record amount of child critical incidents, child fatalities and near fatalities. Just in the first 6 months of 2025, we had nearly 100 critical incidents. And to put that into context, in an 8 month period of time in the blue state of Oregon, they had 21 critical incidents. So it's like having what would be 8 or 9 months in Oregon happening every month in our state. And that's got to stop. We can't continue to watch babies and toddlers being Narcan'd on our streets on King 5 every night.
Yeah. And it is undeniable because you see the graph, the state's own data, Keeping Families Together Act passed, and it's like this. I mean, I don't understand why people would put their heads in the sand over this. So let's start with the good and then talk about the and then the bad. So the good news is, as you said, I mean, even Monica Dingra co-sponsored with Senator Braun over in the Senate a bill that would try to give some parity to, okay, it doesn't matter if you expose your child to meth or to fentanyl, you should still be held accountable for that. And that has the support of the Attorney General. But as you've pointed out, okay, that's talking about what happens to kids after, you know, they've already maybe died or almost died. So the bill that you're trying to and have been trying to strengthen is House Bill 2660. What's the purpose of it?
Yeah, so of course, like, as you know, we had like House Bill 1092, which was my bill to be able to remove kids from these dangerous situations. And then there was a couple that had bipartisan support, and there was a couple bills similar to it by Democrats and Republicans trying to tackle that same issue. And this is before the worst happens, right? This is before the child is victimized. And certainly we do need to update those child endangerment laws. That's important. And I hope that we can pass that finally. We tried to pass that last year and it didn't make it through the Criminal Safety and Injustice Committee with Rep. Roger Goodman as the chair. But right now, the only bill that's going to tackle the before the worst happens is a Lillian Ortiz Self bill, which has a companion bill by Claire Wilson in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And that's 2660. And it deals with the shelter care hearing process where you finally send the parents and the kids to court to decide what's going to happen. And of course, what they did is they wrote a bill that is impossible to basically amend. You have to amend it within the title of the bill. And that's a lot of legalese to basically say they didn't want to have the debate on imminent physical harm. They didn't want to have the debate on how you save kids. They just wanted to basically shuffle the deck chairs on the Titanic and give us a bunch of legal word salad that basically at the end of the day means that we do nothing. It's just a status quo bill. And one of the good things is we heard it in appropriations the other night, and I did get one win for kids, making sure that before we send them back to their homes, that the parents have to be sober, comply with their drug treatment, and that they have to be basically competent parents. And that is not everything, but that is a huge win for child safety advocates like myself and others and foster families, judges, prosecutors, first responders, social workers. But one of the things I think it's important to understand is one of the reasons we have such high critical incidents and child fatalities is because it's nearly impossible to get into that shelter care hearing in the first place because of that imminent physical harm standard. And what I argued is that you know, fentanyl does not care what color you are, doesn't care what sex or gender you are. It just wants to kill you. And the only thing that a parent loves more than their kids, if they're abusing hard drugs like fentanyl, is finding the next hit. And that's sad. I can't believe that we are in a place in this state right now where we can't center child safety in a way that just recognizes that a parent who is abusing fentanyl, smoking fentanyl in their home with their babies and toddlers, throwing up on themselves, urinating on themselves, overdosing on the couch, how that is not a situation in which we need to step in and remove these kids. We've built a system that escalates risk, and we escalate that risk and those traumatic experiences until that child dies or nearly dies. And that's wrong, and we got to fix that. But unfortunately, this bill doesn't do anything right now. So I'm working overtime to find every possible lane and avenue to amend that bill or find other opportunities before the session gavels out. Because, Brandy, you know as well as I do that if we gavel out, then there's no opportunity to fix it. And all we got to do is stand back and watch the unfortunate and needless deaths of kids in our state. And that has to end.
Yeah. Just so I understand, it sounds like you're saying, please correct me if I'm wrong, that if they can get to the point of one of these shelter care hearings, you know, this bill will improve the outcomes for kids. But getting to that point is the challenge that the bar is still too high to force a shelter care hearing, or that it's just too hard to get one because the system's overloaded. So what is the critical step here that's missing?
Yeah, so there's kind of two steps, right? The first step is to get into the shelter care hearing is nearly impossible. But if you can get into it, then they always, the social workers and everyone trying to save kids always loses in court. And so what this bill does is it tries to give the court some kind of new procedures and authority to basically do something. But what the bill does is absolutely nothing. It's basically a circular logic, and it tried to like compel services upon parents, but then make those services voluntary by parents. Okay. So it really doesn't do anything. It's really lipstick on a pig. It's basically, imagine writing a bill to make it look like you did something, but at the same time doing absolutely nothing. And the one amendment that I hung that I mentioned before in the Appropriations Committee a few days back is the only thing that bill does now.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep pushing.
Just so I'm clear, it's the imminent harm standard that still just isn't being met, where it's fentanyl around a kid is imminent harm and we can take your child. That still is not the law, and that's still not in this bill.
Right. Well, the bill itself basically doubles down on the imminent physical harm standard. They don't want to change that. And, you know, that is the absolute thing that we must change. If you don't change that, you're really not doing anything substantial for kids to save them from these dangerous situations. And, you know, the bill basically doubles down on that concept and that idea, but it doesn't actually do anything else. And that imminent physical harm standard applies in court in the shelter care hearing, and it applies before the shelter care hearing as well. And so that's why you get like a 9-year-old in a tent in Aurora with sexual violence and prostitution and fentanyl and rats and all sorts of stuff, because you know, that was before any kind of shelter care hearing. You couldn't even get that 9-year-old into a shelter care hearing to find a better out of home placement or out of tent placement, I might say.
Yeah.
But if you can, even if the social workers know that they have some tools in that shelter care hearing, they might work extra hard to get into that hearing. But oftentimes when they get into that courtroom, they're still met with, no, you can't do this. And the kid gets sent back. That's exactly what happened with the baby Otis in Port Townsend, yeah, who was tossed in the bushes and murdered like that life didn't even matter. You know, you can't do anything in the shelter care hearing because of imminent physical harm. You can barely do anything before the shelter care hearing because of imminent physical harm. And so that is the number one thing we need to change. And I'm looking for every single opportunity to change that. And as a matter of fact, the change I'm trying to make is like is what Oregon has in its statute. I think we would all be pleasantly surprised to wake up to have 25 critical incidents in a year instead of 200. Even though that would still be a work in progress that needs to be worked on. And so I'm just deeply disappointed that something 3 years ago when I got to this place, I never thought it would be so hard, despite some of the differences between the left and the right, that this would be such a hard thing with so obvious data and an obvious solution that we can't just do the simple act of, you know, moderating a law and swinging the pendulum a little bit backwards to child safety, that would be so damn hard in this state. And it makes me sick. It makes me want to crawl out of my own skin every night when I think about this.
Yeah, and I'll take anything, right? I mean, I'll take any sort of improvement over what's happening right now, but anything short of saying it is imminent harm to use fentanyl around a child just isn't enough. Because it is. You can talk about one of the deadliest drugs you can get on the street right now, and you're going to use it and leave it laying around a kid. It's just absolutely insane. So we appreciate Travis's work on that. All right. If you're thinking about selling your home, reach out to our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. And Wes wants to make sure that when it you got the offer, it's on the table, you got the offer, you're trying to close, there's no surprises that pop up at the end that just ruin everything. And so one of the things that Wes does, and some people offer this program, but he was the first one to offer it, and he is the best at doing it. Every listing he sells is pre-inspected. He takes a proactive approach to preparing listings, and over 90% of buyers on his listings use the pre-listing inspection. So it allows folks to waive the inspection contingency, which reduces renegotiations, repair requests, contract fallout, etc. He's been doing it for 10 years. People love it. It's significantly improved outcomes for his clients. And the listing boost concierge service that they offer naturally evolved from that pre-inspection process. Because what that does is they come in, they can help you make cosmetic upgrades. So when you do a pre-inspection, you already kind of know what needs to be repaired, what needs to be dealt with. And they can come in with their listing boost concierge service, get all that done. You don't even have to pay for it until closing. So it really just takes a lot of the stress and uncertainty out of the process. So sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. If you're looking to sell your home, it really just is a better way to sell your home. All right, really quickly before we get to Florida Report, I think there's been a lot of positive developments in Minneapolis. So we know that Tom Homan came in. Trump put him in charge of the situation, and he had some meetings and pretty quickly convinced local authorities to work with the federal government, at least when it comes to handing over individuals who are in jails or prisons or getting out, who are in the country illegally. And he says, because of the cooperation that they've had in the last few weeks, they are going to be drawing down their federal presence in Minneapolis.
I have proposed, and President Trump has concurred, that this surge operation conclude. A significant drawdown has already been underway this week and will continue through the next week. We have a lot of work to do across this country to remove public safety risk who shouldn't even be in this country and to deliver on President Trump's promise for strong border security and mass deportation. Law enforcement officers drawn down from this surge operation will either return to the duty station or be signed elsewhere to achieve just that.
And that's what people want in Minneapolis, right? Wow, look what a little cooperation will do. Isn't that nice? And he also talked about some of the things that they were able to accomplish while they're there. Nobody talks about the missing kids, all the kids who were brought in across the southern border under Biden. He says in Minneapolis and Minnesota, while they were doing this surge, they found a ton of those missing kids.
In addition to taking public safety threats off the street, ICE here in this state have located 3,364 missing unaccompanied alien children. Children that the last administration lost and weren't even looking for. That's because of the leadership of President Trump.
Yeah. And so people weren't even looking for it. And they're the kids. And I don't think they get enough credit for that. And I don't think Biden was criticized enough for all the children that just came into the interior of the country and just vanished. And Lord only knows what some of those kids went through. He also said on his way out that he wanted to clear up some of the misinformation that was spread about what was happening in Minneapolis.
I want to say something about the various unfounded complaints I'm hearing about ICE enforcement operations. During the surge operation, ICE has not arrested anybody inside a hospital. We have not arrested anybody inside of a school, an elementary school. We have not arrested anybody inside a church. As a matter of fact, the only ones that disrespected the sanctuary of a church were the agitators that have been arrested and prosecuted. So far, we have 9 of them.
Yeah, isn't that interesting how they're like, oh, they're coming into churches. They said that was going to be a big thing over the Christmas holiday. They're going to be ripping people out of churches. No, the only people disrupting church services are Don Lemon and his posse. So that's good news out of Minneapolis. And look, this is common sense. Like, hey, let's cooperate. You say you want the worst of the worst. At least cooperate on the worst of the worst then. cooperate with the people who are in jail, in prisons, and then maybe you won't have these chaotic situations out on the streets. All right, it is Thursday. That's when we check in on what's happening in the Sunshine State with my sister Miranda. It is our weekly segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Miranda, hello.
Hello.
So Florida, state of Florida, cracking down on people who are stepping out of line when it comes to their cooperation with ICE as a state.
Yeah, so it is a Florida law that local officials have to cooperate with federal law enforcement agents in the state of Florida. And just last month, there's specifically the mayor of Jacksonville. Her team had a staffer that posted a video kind of calling out where ICE was at in the community and whatnot. And DeSantis called to have that staffer terminated. And all this has kind of led, this and amongst other allegations, has led into our attorney general sending her office a criminal subpoena.
Yeah, and here he is.
Yeah, we have a situation here where a city official was out there, you know, publicly alerting people to ICE locations, interfering with immigration enforcement efforts. This is the state of Florida. It's not Minnesota. We anticipated a special session last year. The governor, under his leadership, made clear we were going to put obligations in that law that passed where local officials, they do not have discretion. There's an obligation to use best efforts to facilitate, help the federal government carry out their law enforcement efforts. We're a rule of law state. We believe in that. We stand by that. And if there's evidence that, you know, the city as a whole, I know the mayor said nothing wrong happened here, we disagree with that. So we're looking at it. If there's a coordinated effort for this city official to work with other city employees or outside NGOs to try to thwart our efforts to enforce the law, then we will hold these wrongdoers accountable.
I love that. Ma'am, this is a Wendy's. It's like, no, this is Florida, not Minnesota. This ain't Minneapolis. And look, no. I mean, look, we just talked about Tom Homan, you know, winding down operations in Minneapolis because they finally got cooperation from, you know, the mayor and from the governor to go in and get the people who they needed to get. And so this stuff is going to happen regardless. President Trump is going to enforce immigration law regardless. Like, do you want to do it the easy way or do you want to do it the hard way?
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, I always, when people want to argue what's happening in Minneapolis, I'm like, ICE is present in every state. And every state that's cooperating with ICE, you don't see what's happening in Minneapolis. And there's a reason for that. Yeah. And it's not ICE. It's cooperation at the state and local level. So yeah,
100%. Yeah. Also, when it comes to the attorney general, he's been in the news quite a bit lately. But you guys have had some of these unhinged nurses and stuff saying crazy things, like, to me, threatening people's lives. Like, if you're in my care, like, I'm going to not give you good care, kill you or do something weird to you if you're a Trump supporter. So you guys have another unhinged nurse.
Another one, which is just so shocking because it's like, you live in Florida, like you should just know better. But this particular nurse, her name's Stephanie, she posted to TikTok saying, can someone explain to me why a patient would express their political views right before going under anesthesia?
Oh my gosh. Like, can you imagine a more vulnerable state to be in than under anesthesia, and your life is in the hands of someone like that?
Yeah.
And so I know Florida, like, didn't they pull the license of the last chick?
Who we said pulled the license of the about, last chick.
That was the Caroline Leavitt chick, right? That was the lady who said she hopes Caroline Leavitt gets some, like, massive terror in giving birth. So what's happening to this lady? Same thing?
So the same thing. Our AG put out a tweet basically saying, here we go again. If you're a medical professional and you threaten the health and safety of others based on their political views, we will send you packing here in Florida. What do you say, Stephanie? Easy way or the hard way?
Good Lord. And people say free speech. No, it's not about free speech. No. There are rules governing medical professionals. And you cannot suggest that you're going to give someone a different standard of care based on their politics. I mean, what the hell is happening to these women of a certain age who have lost their ever loving minds? I just want to meet the men who are married to them. Like, do they know who they were married to? Are they supportive of it? Or is there a lot of men filing for divorce lately? I'm not a big fan of divorce, but hell, you divorce someone who's that crazy. It's just wild.
That's wild.
Absolutely insane. We've been talking a lot about taxes. There's this huge flight from California right now. I know you guys are getting Zuckerberg down there in Miami. So try to make friends with Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos so we can use their yachts next time we go down. Yeah. But Ron DeSantis taking a little shot at the West Coast in our tax policy.
Yeah, he loves to take a little jab every time he can. And it always just makes Florida just that much more of a national, you know, moral compass north for every reason. But he put a tweet out that said, worst states for taxpayers, that a blue state is hostile to taxpayers is about as surprising as the sun rising in the east.
Yes. And he put out a list of the top 10, all Democrat states, including Washington.
Including Washington, all Democrat states. And I looked it up and Florida lands number 5. So the top.
Top. Cool. Yeah. And that's not a surprise. And we're about to get a lot worse. And it's so fascinating to me to watch, like, even Gavin Newsom, and it's probably because he's running for president, but he opposes this billionaire tax proposal in California because he says, look, all the billionaires are going to leave, and they already are. Yeah. And whether that he's doing that, he's trying to moderate himself for 2028, matters not, because that is true. And at the same time, we're still pushing and are going to pass a millionaire's tax here. And I'm like, you realize it's just going to be the same thing. Whether it's a billionaire or a millionaire, you're targeting their wealth for taxation. They're just going to leave, and they already are, to Florida. Yeah. And then there was an article this week about Las Vegas apparently being a very popular place for them to go and take their wealth. So, you know, the middle class is going to be the one stuck holding the bag. All right, one more quickly I want to talk about, since you guys are in your legislative session there as well. It's pretty common here for places of worship, especially synagogues with all the far left radical anti-Semites, to have armed security and to hire armed security companies. But Florida is doing something interesting. They want to make it easier to basically have armed volunteers at the doors of synagogues and places of worship. Is that correct?
Exactly. So this bill that's kind of moving forward would offer more legal protections for places of worship to have unpaid volunteers stand guard at the door with weapons and not have to go through all the scrutiny of getting licensings and stuff from the state. Mm-hmm. Right now, as much as they can do it, it leaves them wide open for civil lawsuits, criminal lawsuits. This would just, you know, kind of create some framework to add protection and allow these places of worship to not have to pay somebody if they have people who want to volunteer to stand and they're trained and ready to protect their place of worship.
Yeah, it's tough because you're never going to be able to eliminate the civil liability altogether. I mean, they can't give them a free pass and say, yep, you can stand out there and shoot anyone and no big deal. No, like, people are always going to be able to sue you, but what kind of protections do you have? But this is interesting because, for instance, I have a lot of people all the time who volunteer to be security for me at protests and all this stuff. And I always say thank you, but no, because they don't have the same insurance, for instance, and legal protections as someone who is maybe an off-duty police officer who I hire officially through a company with a contract, and they have all these protections and under the law, and then also civilly as well, and then, you know, on the back end with insurance. So it's interesting. I wonder, you know, and hopefully they never have to do anything, right? I mean, that's the goal. Is they act as a deterrent, but to be able to have a few more protections if you're doing it for free, I think is a good idea. And unfortunately, it's necessary in today's society.
It's true. I'm assuming a lot of these places of worship have a line of volunteers ready to be there and stand guard while their friends and family worship whatever religion. So I like that the government sees that and wants to create a little protection for that specific little niche of situations that we have with people wanting to be violent these days.
I know. All right, Miranda, good stuff. You look beautiful today, by the way. That turquoise background is really just highlighting your gorgeous hair.
Yes, thank you. This is the one step of many to getting Florida Report's background back in order, so stay tuned.
Yeah, if people don't remember, Miranda moved into a new house. Her office has been undergoing decorations. So yes, we're just going to see a new, I think, background every day until it's done. All right, yep. Miranda, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
I'm in the live chat during that, and everybody's like, Miranda, you're so pretty. Your hair is so beautiful, and your eyes look gorgeous. You guys never say that stuff about me. I never get all this love about my appearance in the live chat.
What? You absolutely do.
I don't think so. I don't think so. I just, you know, now it hurts my feelings. Maybe that's just because my hair looks that good that they're like, I can't even, you know. She already knows. She already knows. All right, we'll get to our daily show poll and comments from the live stream. I'm sure Miranda now, she's going to pick all these comments about how good her hair looks. Oh, we already said it, Miranda.
Well, she definitely is now.
I know. All right. If you're a small to mid-sized landlord in the state of Washington, consider becoming a member of the Rental Housing Association of Washington. There's a ton of good reasons. It's a great networking opportunity. They have events all over the state where you can meet other landlords and housing providers and sort of plot and scheme and complain and, you know, maybe just drink your cares away because it has become such a difficult state in that regard. But they're also down in Olympia this time of year advocating on your behalf. And so that's part of how the cost of becoming a member is used. And then they can help you on a personal basis when you're dealing with issues that arrive. Maybe you've got a troublesome squatter and you're trying to figure out how the hell do I get them out of my house? Well, RHA can help you with that. So RHAWA.org, RHAWA.org. They are Washington's trusted resource, empowering housing providers. All right, our daily show poll. I stole this from Pew Research intentionally because I wanted to see if your answers were similar to nationally what Pew found or if they were off a little bit. So how much confidence do you have in journalists to act in the best interests of the public? A great deal, a fair amount, not too much, or no confidence at all? Nicole?
Oh, well, I mean, it probably depends on the
generally speaking.
Yes. Not too much.
Yeah, I would say I'm at no confidence at all. I hate to say that, but having been there in the belly of the beast, there's a combination of extreme bias and extreme incompetence. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple exceptions to that. Like, I love me some David Rose. I love me some Hannah Kim. Right. There's a couple good people at Como that I would say I have a fair amount of confidence in. But on the whole, no confidence at all. Mm-hmm. You really should have switched those colors up, though. You know, no confidence at all should have been dark red. You know what I mean? Great deal of confidence should have been blue.
Okay.
That's all right. Just something to think about.
Okay. This is what I deal with, people.
I just think, you know, this makes sense. All right. So remember what the national polling showed. The national polling showed that only 6% of Americans overall had a great deal of confidence. Where do you guys stack up? 0% of you said that you have a great deal of confidence. So really, it's not too far off. But yeah, not a lot of confidence. 2% said you had a fair amount of confidence, which is well below what Pew found. 52% said not too much, and 46% said no confidence at all. So well above the national average of people. But yeah, across all of our platforms, 0% chose a great deal of confidence. And that's probably why you support an independent news show, because you have no confidence in legacy news. Crafty Grandma Crispy echoing Nicole saying, it depends on the actual journalist. Jeremy Harris and Chris Daniels at Como do decent work. I agree with that. But then I look at independents like Jonathan Cho, Andy Ngo, Brandy Cruz, etc. Greg said, I have no confidence in legacy media journalists, new journalists such as yourself and Jonathan Cho and others I do have confidence in. And like I always say, you know, to me, the whole issue here is sort of honesty and transparency and self-awareness. It bothers me when you have these legacy reporters who genuinely think they're acting in a non-biased fashion. And they're clearly biased, like the whole right-wing, left-leaning thing. You're clearly biased. Let's just put it all out there. Let's put all our cards on the table and say, this is my personal political beliefs. And then I'm going to go cover things. And then you're armed with all the information you need to decide how trustworthy my coverage is. It's like, hey, I voted for Donald Trump. You know, I'm able to criticize him sometimes, but you're armed with that knowledge. When you hear my coverage and my opinions on things that Donald Trump is doing, I think that's fair. I think that's transparency. I think that's being trustworthy. And the media believes they're more trustworthy because they hide their personal political beliefs and then they go about doing their job. I just think that Americans are over that model because they're suspicious. Why is their coverage so biased? They must be a Democrat or whatever it is. Let's see. A lot of people saying it really depends on the journalist. And I do agree with that. But I think Pew is getting at overall. Lynn says, not in legacy media, but certainly independent media. I have a great deal of confidence. Greg, I unsubscribe to papers due to bias and untruthful reporting. Local TV media definitely portrays bias to political issues. And there's this issue of Hello, Nicole.
Hi.
Pickett, we're both in black today.
I know.
It's the last day of the week for us, and so we get sad, you know?
How is it Thursday already?
We don't get sad.
It's crazy.
We love you guys, but we don't get sad. Have a three-day weekend, although we both work all weekend anyway. Mm. There's also this this issue of things that have become off limits to legacy news that makes them untrustworthy. Like the boys and girls sports, transgender issues and all that, off limits. Oh my gosh, we can't cover that. And so then it makes you untrustworthy because there's issues for fear of offending people that you won't dive into that are absolutely things the public needs to know about.
I did text you yesterday because I did hear our
story. You text me a lot in a single day.
Well, I did hear our story on Cairo Radio.
Yeah, they got a big fact on it wrong, but...
I know, but at least they have a story and they presented it the way...
They did the wrestler story.
They included that this was a trans person. I don't love all the language, but... I mean, that's the first story of this type that we've had picked up by any of those.
Yeah, I mean, the story about the Puyallup wrestler who says she was sexually violated by a boy, trans-identifying boy, that she didn't even know was a boy. I mean, it went crazy national. We talked about that on the show yesterday, and I continue to see it shared by major accounts, which is great, but legacy news doesn't touch this stuff. So yeah, MyNorthwest.com, which is Cairo News Radio in Seattle, did a story on it, and I'm very appreciative of that because I think this needs to get into the mainstream. But they said she didn't report it for 2 months. And that's a huge part of the story. No, she told her coach immediately, and her parents in an email 2 days after told her coach.
They have two write-ups on it. One of them got it right.
Maybe they corrected it because I did call them out for that factual error, because that's a big part of it is, no, she did report it. Mm-hmm. It was their obligation to report it to the state. All right. On how the media weaponizes words, Denise Young, I canceled my Seattle Times years ago. So here's what I would have saved this month by not having the Seattle Times. Gave us a $20 super chat. Well, I said yesterday on the show, I want to come up with a way to like encourage people to cancel their Seattle Times subscriptions.
Do you know how much it is?
How much is it?
I was shocked.
How much is it?
So the Sunday paper, if you were to buy it in the store, I believe it's $8. And then it's like $15 a week.
A week?
$15 or $16
to get it delivered.
Right.
Like a hard paper. Right. Yeah.
But $15 a week,
you're paying what is the digital subscription?
$60 a month for the Seattle Times.
For the Seattle Times.
No, the digital is... I think it was $9.99 a week.
We've never raised our prices.
Yes.
Still doesn't even matter with inflation. $5.
Who pays that?
Yeah, that's crazy. Old Sub Sailor, protect the truth, truth sayers like Brandy, Nicole, Miranda, and all the good people who support Undivided. I agree. Little Miss J, my support and confidence in Brandy and Nicole is why I send donations and our love. Thank you both deeply. Thank you. Although they're not donations, I do have to tell people that supporting Undivided is not tax deductible. Right. I just want you to know. Moon Goddess, sending love to one of the few truthful journalists. Thank you guys. You're so nice to me today and every day. You're always nice. Country Guy, by calling you a right-wing journalist, they are contrasting themselves as being left-wing. I mean, technically, if you feel the need, because they'll never refer to, like Don Lemon. Do you think any of the mainstream coverage of Don Lemon's arrest referred to him as a left-wing podcaster? Even though they're cheering them on? No. But had a Republican done it, it's right-wing. And they don't see how silly that is. Let's see here. Sergeant Pickles. They know on the Democrats wanting to make elections less secure. They know we're on to their mass cheating. Every attempt to hide it makes me believe it's worse than we even imagine. And look, I get that. I have to see evidence to believe there's mass cheating. I have to see evidence and proof to believe that there's widespread fraud. That's just in my nature. But doth protest too much. There is a point that he's making there, that the more you dig your heels into common sense reforms, the more I'm like, all right, maybe they are hiding quite a bit of fraud. Mm-hmm. On the dad going to the school board meeting, I love Vance. I'm fitting for the race. I was like, he's so funny. Greg Olakis, I love that dude. His passion is top shelf. Yeah. Top shelf. Jeff,
suit he wore on her.
I know. He gets up like butt crack a dawn after working all day and he's got his hair done and his suit on. I'm like, you look so nice. Thank you for taking our show seriously and to want to wear a suit.
I know, so sweet.
Jeff Osberg, did you see that the mayor of Seattle directed school children to stay in school and not attend the Seahawks parade, but she will allow school children to attend protests against ICE? I hadn't seen that.
Oh, I haven't.
Well,
seen
that. They said that attending the parade would be an unexcused absence.
Yes, I saw that.
And I agree with that. And in Seattle Public Schools, I also believe it's an unexcused absence to protest. So there actually is parity there. But Democrats have introduced a bill, which I'm not sure if it's going to continue this session or if it's already timed out, that would say it is an excused absence to protest. So as long as it's consistent, that doesn't bother me. Because if you had given kids an excused absence to attend the Seahawks protest, literally you might as well have just shut down school for the day. Because
the
nobody
only thing that
gone.
Really bothered me about this is that Katie pretending she's a sports fan at all. And then I felt like it was the socialist city against the Patriots.
Oh,
and then
I know.
The socialist city won. It was the only thing that Bummer. Was in my brain the whole time. Like, that's the only bummer.
Katie
We're
Wilson.
Still Seattle Seahawks.
Katie Wilson, who's sort of this nerdy sort of, and that's fine. That's fine. But don't pretend you're something you're not. She's like in this video with like her legs spready and she's got like a football. And I'm like, okay, just don't try.
Don't
stop.
Try.
Just
don't
stop.
Try.
It's okay.
It can be like the Bellevue Seahawks or something.
Yeah. Bill Biz, it's truly amazing that requiring voter ID is controversial. It's not. It's not. Wes Steed, can we vote on this 3-hour show idea? No, Nicole's not going to allow a vote on that. Sergeant Pickle said, the Cruz family seemingly blessed with good hair. Yeah, yeah, thank you.
Should with that... We should give your brothers a couple cameos or
they
something.
They have fine hair.
Need to, yeah.
They have fine hair. Mm. Somebody asked, does Nicole have an engagement ring on? I don't think so. Wrong,
this is
wrong,
the wrong hand.
Huh? All right. Thank you, Nicole. With that, we'll get to our closing sanity check in a moment. First, I just keep hearing great things about First Mark Insurance from you guys. We just got this from Robin. I joined the First Mark family and I'm going to be saving $100 a month. Yes, $100 a month. You know, I'm not good at math, but I'm pretty sure that's $1,200 a year. And who could not use an extra $1,200 a year, which is just fantastic, all by taking the First Mark challenge, setting aside a little bit of time to have them give you a second look at your insurance, you know, talk to you about your insurance needs, what's going on with your family, maybe your business. I mean, I use First Mark for personal and for business and just love it, love their proactive service. And then they'll go out, shop their market, come back with recommendations, and you too could be saving hundreds, if not thousands of dollars a year. And they're not going to cheap out and get you crap insurance. This is about a balance, making sure you have the right insurance. We're all adults. We worked hard for our stuff. Now, I'm not going to call out any specific insurance companies, but you know the ones where you're like, oh, that's check the box insurance. That's check the box because I legally am required to have it, but it's not going to cover you. That's not what we're doing at First Mark. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you, not the insurance companies. So they always have your best interest in mind. And with that, let's get to our closing sanity check. I love this for a couple reasons, but my friend Seamus Bruner, who was on the Antifa roundtable with me, he's just like a quiet workhorse. So he definitely wasn't one of the most boisterous members. He doesn't do stuff really on camera. His thing with Antifa and left-wing extremism is following the money. That's what he does. He's the vice president of the Government Accountability Institute, and he's an expert in dark money networks. So he got called to appear in a congressional hearing, which I just love for him. He did such a fantastic job. But Senator Josh Hawley had asked him a question about whether his organization has followed the money on what was funding some of these protests and riots in Minneapolis over ICE. And the data that they found that cannot be disputed is astonishing.
Your organization specializes in following nonprofit funding and organizational networks. So based on your research, what organizations have been active on the ground in Minnesota? What can you tell us?
Yes, we have tracked over $60 million, according to the latest 990 disclosures, to approximately 14 groups, some of them national, others on the ground. Groups like the ACLU provide the legal defense, as well as facilitate the trainings for some of the tactics that Senator Corin just described. A group named Democracy Forward, Take Action Minnesota, has gotten over $10 million from these large NGO networks, including the Neville Roy Singham Network, Indivisible, National Lawyers Guild, CTUL, the Council on American Islamic Relations Minnesota, CARE, Minnesota 350, Voices for Racial Justice, on and on. Like I said, over $60 million, just according to the latest 990 disclosures.
$60 million, 14 at least, 14 different groups. That sounds like a pretty broad ecosystem here. Where's this money coming from? I mean, how is it flowing to these groups? Do you have any sense?
So we've built a database that contains hundreds of thousands of rows from grants from networks like the Soros Network, the Arabella Funding Network, as mentioned, the Neville Roy Singham Funding Network, many others, Tides, the Ford Foundation Network, the Rockefeller Funding Network, these massive NGOs that have billions of dollars to spend on all kinds of coordinated protest or, in this case, riot activity.
$60 million. Yeah. So if that didn't seem like it just popped up naturally, it's because it doesn't. You just don't see that kind of paid organizational activity on the right at all. Although, when 60,000 people sign in Olympia opposed to an income tax measure, what does the left say? Oh, those are bots. Those are bots. Must be. Has to be. Okay. Yeah. You guys are real life bots. That has been our closing sanity check. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Coming up on Sundays with subscribers this week, our exclusive Sunday show for subscribers, we're going to be talking to the business community about the impact that the proposed tax on millionaires is likely to have on even small businesses whose owners are definitely not millionaires. And they're going to take us through some of their startling numbers from Washington businesses, with about half of them, half of Washington business owners considering right now moving out of the state. It's just crazy. So we'll have that. We'll have a new episode of Politics Unpacked to help you make sense of what happened this week in the legislative session. We'll have a new episode of Swamp Watch with Zach Abraham. Oh my gosh. Wow. We do a lot. You should really subscribe for $5 a month. Cheaper than the Seattle Times and better than the Seattle Times. UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com. Click on the banner that says support the show for $5. But if you're not a subscriber, I guess we'll just see you on Monday.